Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. I like using leftovers in my cooking. I always have. It's fun to see what you have in the fridge and figure out something new you can do with it. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest takes it a step further and plans in advance. She cooks meals with a second recipe in mind right from the start, so we can get another completely different meal out of the parts of our cooking that take the most effort. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite kinds of leftovers? Do you like to eat them as is or make something new out of them? And do you ever cook meals thinking, this is meal A, but I'm coming in with a plan for meal B coming out of this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Cassie Joy Garcia is the creator and editor-in-chief of the food and wellness blog Fed and Fit. She's a cookbook author, most recently of Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. Cassie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I love this cookbook. All the recipes come in pairs. So one common ingredient you make goes into both of them. What started you down this road of kind of thinking ahead this way?
Necessity. I'm the mother of two small children, soon to be three in just a couple of months. And I work full time. And we just have a very richly scheduled household, if you will. And for some reason, getting dinner on the table night after night, even though I love to cook and I have been a recipe developer for over a decade now, was leaving me feeling exhausted and burnout. And I needed a more efficient system.
How do you go looking for pairs of recipes? We're going to check out some of these recipes in a bit, but where do you find, like, okay, if I do this work once, most of this cooking is going to transfer over to meal B?
You know, it really started with wanting to not only make life as easy as possible and roll that effort forward, like you said so well already, but wanting to keep some variety in what we were plating on the table night after night. Food boredom, especially through the pandemic, was something that we were really bumping up against, getting tired of the same dishes over and over again. And so wanting to mix in different varieties. And so what I found myself doing was, for example, cooking up a beautiful brisket for one night, serving it up with some pretty classic sides, maybe a slaw and maybe a polenta, for example, but then finding myself craving Mongolian beef, you know, a Chinese inspired dish, and using that brisket to help that come to life, but in a really quick way. And so it was more along the lines of what would be really exciting, what would be an exciting meal to have either the next day or the day after that.
I love this because I have done the thing like, okay, I'm going to make a lot of this food so we have lots of leftovers. And then day three, I'm pretty tired of those leftovers. All right, let's get into some concrete recipes. You've shared these with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Our first pairing centers around chicken, roasted chicken. So let's start with the first recipe in this pairing, roasted chicken and potatoes with fresh arugula salad. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yes. So this is the... I'm a big believer in, I think we're making recipes a little too complicated. And so this recipe is such a great showcase of that because it's a roasted chicken that is so simply done, very, very simply done, but you're going to get maximum flavor and results. I wanted to make sure that this was a book that you could drop into the lap of somebody who was really a beginner in the kitchen, and they could confidently follow these steps and produce a really reliable, high quality result. So you're going to get this beautiful roasted chicken. And while the oven's on, I say, let's pop in some potatoes and roast up some potatoes along with that chicken. And then toss together a really nice, light, and simple arugula salad to go with it. If you're family or if you don't like arugula, spinach would be a really great one for one swap. And that would be meal one. And we would make that chicken with in mind, I'm going to make twice as much chicken than I know what we need tonight for dinner. And then those planned for leftovers. So if that means one bird for your head, that would be one chicken in my house. But I know in many homes, that would be two chickens or more. So the planned for leftovers already roasted, that gets put into the refrigerator for meal two.
And meal two, then we've got this chicken handy because we made extra and we don't need to put any more time into making the chicken. Now we've got the key ingredient for butter chicken bowls with white rice.
Yes. And oh my goodness, are you in for a treat? That dinner is so delicious. So it's this Indian inspired dish, my version of buttered chicken. And it is a really delicious, creamy, tomatoey sauce with some really lovely, bold spices, but that comes together really quickly. And so what I like to do is take that leftover chicken, planned for leftover chicken, right? Chop it up, sear it in some either ghee or butter or olive oil, whatever you've got within reach. And then we just create the sauce really quickly in the same skillet and then serve this yummy curry style sauce over a fluffy white rice. And only the cook in the home is going to know that this was tied so closely with that roasted chicken dinner that you had already with the potatoes and the arugula. Nobody else who might be enjoying this fabulous meal is going to be really any the wiser.
You can find both those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Cassie Joy Garcia is our Food Friday guest this week. We're talking about her book, Cook Once, Dinner Fix, Quick and Exciting Ways to Transform Tonight's Dinner into Tomorrow's Feast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook meals with leftovers in mind, either with a plan to eat exactly that same meal again and again, or to know you're going to use the outcome of this dinner to make something completely different tomorrow? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cassie, I do the grocery shopping for my household in addition to a lot of the cooking. This seems like a fun way. This would be fun to shop for, right? I know this is the centerpiece. This is the common trait of these two meals. And then I'm just like building both of them out of that. Is this kind of fun at the store?
I think it's fun. You know, if you're somebody who enjoys efficiencies, you're going to get a kick out of it.
Because, and I am.
Yes, exactly. You know, if it's the way that I structured the book is it's not broken up. It's not really your typical recipe book. It's not broken up by appetizers, sides, and desserts, and so on. The book is broken up into 5 chapters that feature the main component. And so there's a poultry chapter, pork, beef, seafood, and vegetarian. And my hope is that when you go through the grocery store, let's say if you find your favorite ground beef is on sale, then you would know, oh gosh, I'm going to go find a dinner series that calls for ground beef, because a ground beef dinner series is going to have you brown up, crumble 3 pounds of ground beef at once, and then split it between 2 wonderful meals. And so it makes it really fun to shop and really shop efficiently.
Another thing I love about how you're talking about your meals and how you write about them in the book is the flexibility. Like earlier you mentioned, use ghee or butter or olive oil. You know, they might taste a little different. It's all going to come out fine. You give suggestions like that. Also, like, hey, you want this gluten-free? In some cases, here's how. You want this veggie? Do this instead of this. And I think that's a great attitude toward cooking. Why is that important to you?
You know, I want my recipes to be as approachable and inclusive as possible, and none of them are really precious to me. I'm a pretty terrible recipe follower myself, and I find myself saying, oh, that sounds good, but I'm going to try it with this, you know? And I think there's a lot of fun and creativity that can come out of the kitchen when you approach it with that kind of anything's possible attitude. And it can just be a really fun activity, I think, if you if you just want to be a little bit more creative. And also, if that makes you nervous and you'd prefer to follow the recipe to the letter, I've got you covered.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Freedom. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your recipe combo, John?
I will start with a tongue taco, so I'll try to follow a traditional Mexican recipe. Herbs, garlic, bay leaves, spices, simmer that for 3 hours. After rinsing my scotch and whiskey bottles, a little bouillon. I then strain off that broth, and I will make beef barley soup, pot roast. Any leftover wine that we don't want will go in the pot roast. You can save broth anytime you want.
Awesome. I love it, John. I like the crossover. So the broth from cooking the meat part of his meal ends up being a soup. I kind of go the other way. I'll make extra of, say, the chicken or whatever, knowing that, you know, over the weekend, I'm going to put that into a big soup. What do you think? What do you think, Cassie?
I think that's brilliant. My goodness. That sounds great.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, John, at 800-642-1234. We heard from Darlene on Facebook who said the whole reason for cooking is to have leftovers. I love it. Do you, how are you, Cassie, at sort of the scrounge? Like I do a lot, you know, oh, I've got this in the fridge. I'm going to build a meal around that. You're thinking ahead, but I imagine you still do some improvising.
Oh yeah, there's lots of improvising within bounds. You know, I found that if I really want to use up, I really love being able to use up all the vegetables. And I'm not going to say that I've got a perfect record or anywhere close to that, but some of our scrounge meals, if you will, is I will, if a recipe calls for half of an onion, or, you know, three carrots, or just not all the mushrooms that I have on hand. All of those extras of those vegetables go into what my veggie bowl in the refrigerator. It sits out right in the front. And then every week I do a red sauce for my girls. They love it with spaghetti. And I toss all those extra vegetables in there. And it becomes a really quick and easy way to scrounge for those leftover ingredients, the things that you've just got on hand. And it's a bit of a mystery, but you get to up the veggie content in that sauce.
That sounds awesome. We're talking to Cassie Joy Garcia on this week's edition of Food Friday. Talking about cooking meals with a plan for leftovers. She's the author of the book Cook Once, Dinner Fix. Quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like doing creative things with leftovers from last night's meal? Or do you cook tonight's meal knowing you're going to use all or part of it in something similar or maybe something completely different? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, a cauliflower combo. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Timely news, fascinating conversations, stimulating music, or laugh out loud entertainment. There's something for everyone on WPR. Individuals and families who donate are the largest source of support for the programs you enjoy. Thank you, members. You make it all possible.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Join us for Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide.
Coming out of the gate.
We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Saturday morning at 11 on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with professional home cook Cassie Joy Garcia. Her new cookbook is Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. Lots of pairs of recipes so you can use your labor twice. That roasted chicken goes into two completely different dishes, for example. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cassie, before we go back to our callers, we got some chicken recipes earlier. You also shared some cauliflower recipes, starting with General Tso's cauliflower. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is right out of the vegetarian chapter, and I love this dinner series. So we start off with, essentially, we want you to grab 3 to 4 heads, depending on how large they are, of cauliflower. Go ahead and cut off the florets, and we're going to roast them very simply with some olive oil, salt, and pepper. And then once they come out and they're nicely cooked, we're going to toss it around in a sticky, somewhat sweet, a little spicy General Tso's style sauce. And it creates this really delicious dish. And I serve that over fluffy white rice for meal number one.
And then meal number two, we got all this cauliflower lying around. Cauliflower tinga tacos.
Oh, gosh, that is a really tasty dish, and I'm so excited for folks to try it. So cauliflower tinga tacos, it is a Mexican-style flavor profile, and it's a tomato-y sauce that has some chipotle in there. There's some good heat, some lime juice, and we create this really delicious rub, toss the cauliflower in that, and re-crisp it. And so that really brings the cauliflower, even though it's already cooked, and maybe you're on it's day three, right, of the cauliflower being cooked, brings it back to life and gives it new life, if you will, with this brand new sauce. Toast up some, I prefer some corn tortillas over a flame on the stove, and get those nice and bristled or blistered, and then serve the tinga filling in there with some avocado and lime juice. It's delicious.
Sounds fantastic. You can find that recipe at WPR, both those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Green Bay. Susan, hi.
Hi. I just enjoy listening to this show, and I just wanted to make one comment. I am going to purchase this cookbook for my daughter. She's a 20-something, lives alone, not, you know, the most seasoned cook. But when you're cooking and for one person, there's often so many leftovers. And I think this is a great idea for a single person and what to do with the leftovers. Love the creative ideas, and I also love that there's a gluten-free and a vegetarian option as well. So I'm going to purchase this for my daughter for Christmas.
All right. Well, Merry Christmas to her. Susan, thanks for calling. Cassie, do you have thoughts on tailoring your combo recipes for cooking for one?
I do. Yes, actually. And I have actually a consideration in the front of that book. That's a question I get a lot in a lot of my recipe development projects is how do we scale this either for one or many, many more people. And so I have a bit of a compass in there for folks, but I say, you know, these recipes are written intentionally so that the math is going to be really easy, whether you're cutting it in half or doubling or tripling. So hopefully she feels very well supported with it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Susan. We're talking to Cassie Joy Garcia. Her new book is Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us now in Wausau. Hey, Steve.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a avid believer of what we're talking about right now and do it all the time personally, but what I'm calling about is professionally. I've got 30 years of experience working with the nonprofit human sector, and for a while I drove a truck which would deliver food to a soup kitchen. And the cool thing was that there was one restaurant who gave us what we called what's in the refrigerator soup. And they would just put it together, and sometimes it had, you know, just all edible stuff, all good stuff, but it was their way of making a contribution to the soup kitchen. So this is my call out to restaurants and professionals to say, hey, how can you repurpose and encouraging, you know, upscaling and serving more people with leftovers. It's a great idea.
Oh, interesting, Steve. That is how I make soup at home, too. What's in the fridge soup. That's an interesting idea, Cassie. The pros at the restaurants can do something like this. In this case, they did for a soup kitchen.
I love it. That's brilliant.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Steve. It's soup season here in Wisconsin, Cassie, or it's starting to be. I love making soup. What are some of your favorite ways to take leftovers out of the fridge or previous meals and soupify them?
Oh, my goodness. There are unlimited possibilities. I actually just made 3 big soups yesterday.
Wow.
And chicken, of course, is usually one that we're grabbing pretty often. But shredded chicken, I will make anytime I'm making shredded chicken, let's say for a casserole or something like that, I will usually double the amount of protein that I'm making and then store that shredded chicken in the refrigerator if I know I'm going to use it right away or in the freezer. And then yesterday, for example, I pulled together this lemon turmeric ginger soup with chicken and sweet potato, and then tossed them some kale. And it was just really lovely and wonderful, but it came together so quickly. It was the most work involved was chopping up the sweet potato.
If you're making 3 soups at once, I'm going to go on a limb, Cassie, and guess that you're freezing some of those.
It's the postpartum baby prep.
No, but that's great. So what, and you actually talk a little bit about what can you freeze, what can you assume is going to change or not in the freezer. What are your thoughts for that convenient meal prep on the sorts of things that we can make with freezing in mind?
Yes. You know, there's a lot I think that might actually be the beefiest part of that front part of the book is my freezer guide, because it is also definitely a frequently asked question. There's so much. If you've got the space available in your freezer, if you have a freezer and it's just not well organized, it might be really great motivation to get in there and tidy it up a bit, because there's so much that you can do to organize your freezer, to set yourself up for success, to do future you some favors. And so I walk you through freezing either fresh components, so fresh ingredients, fresh vegetables, shopping while things are in season, and also freezing cooked components and how you might move through that. And then when it comes to reheating, which is a frequently asked question, what's the best way to reheat this dish or this kind of dish? What I usually like to tell folks is I think that the best place to reheat something is where you would have cooked it the first time. So if it's a casserole, for example, then I like to reheat it in the oven where I would have baked that casserole to begin with. Or if it was a soup or a chili, that would go on the stovetop in a pot.
Before we wrap up, Cassie, I remember when my twins were infants and I got really good at making things that you could prep during nap time. And then you could leave them in the oven or whatever when the kids got back up and they'd cook in time for dinner. Do you have any advice for fitting in that meal prep during a short nap time?
Oh, my goodness, do I. That's how I move through the day. So I say do the thing while you have the time to do it.
Yeah.
And even if it is as simple as pulling out your rice and leaving it in a measuring cup or in the pot on the stove without water, but the water measured next to it. So as you've got it out, because for me, I'm carrying around an 18-month-old on one hip with a big old baby belly. And it's just the possibility of doing more things with one hand or fewer in the hours to come. So do as much as you can, get as much out, your mise en place, if you will, during that nap time.
And Cassie, what's for dinners this weekend?
Oh gosh, dinner this weekend. We're going to have carnitas. We're diving into the pork chapter. It's a most loved dinner series. We're going to have those crispy, perfect carnitas cooked down a pork shoulder. And then meal two is the sticky honey garlic pork Asian style dish that my family just loves.
And when can I show up?
Anytime. You're welcome. Anytime.
Cassie, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Cassie Joy Garcia, creator and editor-in-chief of the food and wellness blog Fed and Fit. She's also a cookbook author. Most recently, the book we've been talking about, Cook Once, Dinner Fix, quick and exciting ways to transform tonight's dinner into tomorrow's feast. We have a couple pairs of recipes up at WPR.org/Food Friday, one based on chicken, one based on cauliflower. Make them this weekend. Make them both and let us know how it all turned out. Coming up, a lot of us have a few favorite movies we can list, but what actually makes them great? A Wisconsin film scholar helps us learn how to watch movies like an expert. From the quiet dramas to the action blockbusters, we'll find out what we can watch for to appreciate the movies even more. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrin. Between how a movie looks, sounds, and how it's put together, there's a lot of work that goes into making a film. And when it all goes well, it's a seamless experience for us, the viewers. But if you've ever wanted to dig deeper and learn how to watch a film like an expert, this conversation is for you. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is Associate Professor of English and Director of Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She talked earlier this fall with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson.
We're talking about movies and specifically what separates maybe a casual movie viewer from a film buff.
Yeah, I think the thing that separates a casual viewer from a film buff, you can really boil it down to passion, right? Like you don't have to have absolute skills and total, you know, an abundance of degrees in order to love film. You just need to come to it with a passion. That said, it can be useful to have some basic ideas of how film functions in order to get a bit deeper into your analysis.
Well, let's talk about some of those functions because, you know, sometimes I sit down, watch a movie, hit play, watch it, and then I'm done. And maybe I don't think about it anymore. So what are some of those functions and how can people maybe bring them into their practice a little?
There's absolutely no problem with sitting down and just enjoying something and turning your head off for a little bit, because I do that too, right? We all do that. And there's no shame. You know, I always say there's no guilty pleasure. There's just pleasure. But I think that having access to some of these different kinds of ideas about how film works can increase your pleasure. It can actually be a different kind of pleasure in movie watching. The first thing we all come to movies with is narrative, right? That's generally the first thing we think about, is how movies tell a story. And that's a great place to start. So the first place I often recommend that people look is, how is the story told? Whose perspective is the story told from? Are we following one main character? Are we following multiple characters? Do we get a sense that we have a kind of objective perspective, or is there a subjective one? All of these are ways that we think about storytelling that really come from literature to a large extent. So that's the first place that I recommend we start. We start at storytelling and at character. But film is not literature. That's really important to stress. It's not literature. It's something completely different. It's something that's made up of images and sounds and very, very detailed and careful structure that is made by an entire group of people. It's one of the really wonderful things about film. So what I also then recommend looking at, as we move from narrative, which is kind of like the first level, as we start to kind of excavate into what film means, there's four major elements of film form that I recommend we take a look at. The first one would be mise-en-scène, which is a fancy French way of saying everything that's contained in the frame. So that's everything from lighting to costuming to sets and settings, even to the actors themselves. So like everything you see in the frame, that's mise-en-scène. So pay attention to what's in the mise-en-scène. That gives you a sense of how the larger story world operates. The next thing I recommend looking at is sound. And well, I guess you'd be hearing sound, right? So the next thing I recommend paying attention to is sound. How is the sound constructed? How are people talking? What kinds of sounds are you hearing? How is the music used? The next element we look at is cinematography. And cinematography is, of course, camera work. How the camera's moving, what we see via the lens of the camera, which really functions as our eyes on the scene. And finally, the last thing I would recommend that we look at in order to watch movies like a movie buff is editing. And that can be the most difficult one to consider, because most films are edited so that we don't notice how the editing functions. Most films use what we call invisible editing. And that's because editing serves to suture the story together and make sense. So that can be the hardest one to look at, but that's the kind of fourth level of excavating film form for thinking about movies like a movie buff.
So Jocelyn, let's work backwards then with these examples, with these terms, because you just were talking about editing and how it's supposed to be invisible. You're not supposed to see it, but there are examples in the broader cinematic world where you can see these edits. One of the films that comes to mind is Godard's Breathless, which is a very strange film to watch if you've only seen movies that are maybe by American directors or American editors. Can you talk a little bit about that film? Because it was kind of groundbreaking.
Yeah, that's a great example, JC, because when that came out, it is in large part the editing that was so shocking to audiences. Of course, that's probably the most famous film coming out of the French New Wave. And the French New Wave was often deliberately provocative. What directors like Godard wanted to do was break apart what they saw as a very kind of like machine-made approach to filmmaking in general. So in something like Breathless, you'll see a lot of use of what we might call jump cuts. And jump cuts are when, I mean, you know it when you see it, right? You know a jump cut when you see it. It's when the camera angle changes, but the mise-en-scène, i.e. whatever's in the frame, does not. Or it's when the mise-en-scène changes and the camera angle does not. And it effectively serves to kind of shock the audience a little bit, because it doesn't function like a normally edited conversation or scene might function. Now, how this works then for Godard is that it calls our attention to the fact that we're actually watching a movie. We're not just immersed. We're not just swept up in the storyline. Instead, we're reminded over and over and over again that we are watching a thing that is being constructed in front of our eyes. And that's what Godard wanted to have happen. He wanted to break that immersion that the audience experiences in order to make a larger political point.
We are talking to Jocelyn Sapania-Galise, Associate Professor of English and Director of Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And right now we are talking about how people can watch movies like a film buff or a film expert. And we are going over right now some of the terminology. And we just talked about editing. And moving backwards, I want to talk about cinematography because, as you said, the cinematographer is basically our eyes on what is happening in this film. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how cinematography has evolved over time?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such a kind of massive element of film form. In some ways, it's kind of like the most fundamental because it involves working with the camera. Early on in the history of film, the camera tends to be more static, more stable, and then various kinds of technologies make it possible for the camera to move around. Tracks, eventually things like zoom lenses in the mid-century become something that's much more widespread. So cinematography and the things that can be done with the camera really do shift over time in terms of how mobile the camera is, and thus how mobile we are. Today, it's not uncommon to see drone shots especially in like openings of films, right? And that would have been really staggering for even a cinematographer in the 70s to see. But when we think about cinematography, one of the things that I think is most important to think about is not just what we see in the frame, but what the cinematographer and the camera crew have chosen to leave out of the frame, right? We get this sense often that like, oh, we get this really expansive view, whatever. What is almost as important as what's there is what's left out, because that gives us insight into what we're supposed to focus our attention on, and as well as what the wider world of the film might be if we had more to see beyond what is in the frame.
And I guess in that vein, do you have any films that are at the top of your list that you think are just excellent examples of cinematography?
Absolutely. One of my favorite films to talk about and to teach when I teach cinematography is John Frankenheimer's film Seconds from 1966. It stars Rock Hudson. It's really, really an incredible film. It's kind of like a scary psychological science fiction drama about a man who gets the option to completely get rid of the life that he has and enter a new life entirely. And the way that it's done is that he has this this really massive kind of plastic surgery and bodily overhaul, and then enters into an entirely new life. An entirely new life where he's now played by Rock Hudson, right? So he gets very handsome and young, of course, as he makes this kind of transformation. The film is shot by James Wong Ho, who was one of the most prestigious cinematographers in the American mid-century, really, really fabulous cinematographer. And what's so amazing about the cinematography in this film is that it kind of changes as the film goes on. So when we get this emergence of the main character into the body of Rock Hudson, the cinematography starts to get kind of canted, right? So that means that a canted angle is when the camera is kind of off kilter. It's also referred to as a Dutch angle. So it's like we don't have like a perfectly stable image. Instead, everything is kind of shifted over to one side or the other. And what that does when we're watching this film is that it gives the audience the experience that they have entered into a body that's not their own as well. So it's kind of like the style of the cinematography is embodying the experience of the main character. There's a couple scenes where he gets like totally plastered drunk with all of his friends. And in those moments, the cinematography tends to be much more handheld. It tends to be really jerky. And we similarly get this experience of feeling really nauseated, really drunk, and it's all done via the way that James Wong Ho shoots the film. It's really, really incredible.
We're learning how to watch movies like a film expert. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee is our guest, talking with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson. More to come in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're learning what to watch for in movies that can help us think like a film expert. UW-Milwaukee professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is our guest. Here's the rest of her conversation with J. Carlisle Larson.
So, Jocelyn, we've been talking about the visuals of film, but let's talk about the sound of film. People obviously are aware of scoring and soundtracks, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to talk about the natural sound that comes up in films and what people should be listening for in films, because there's a lot going on with sound that we aren't aware of as viewers.
Absolutely. And we can think of sound as a kind of counterpart to cinematography, because sound also implies not just what we hear, but what we're not hearing. So sound can be used to reduce what we're hearing in accordance with the perspective of the character we're following, for example. So one of the most famous examples of this is Francis Ford Coppola's film, The Conversation, from the 1970s. And in this film, which is, it's very, very famous for its creative use of sound. In this film, the main character is following a couple. He's a private investigator who's been hired to kind of follow this couple and find out what's going on with them. And he records their conversations over time and records them outside as they're walking around a park. And he's trying to piece together exactly what's going on with this couple. And the centerpiece of this film, appropriately enough, since it's called The Conversation, is this one conversation that he records where the couple says to one another, he'd kill us if he got the chance. And so the entire film is constructed around what the meaning of this particular sentence is in this particular conversation. As we watch the film, and as we get deeper into the perspective of the main character, we then begin to understand that he has had certain prejudices around how he's hearing this conversation, such that he's interpreted it one way, when at the end it turns out that he was interpreting it entirely the wrong way. And at that moment, the sound that we hear actually changes. Coppola changes how we've heard that conversation in order to show us that we've only been understanding the story via the lens of this one character. So we've kind of been a bit tricked, right, throughout the course of the film, simply by how the sound has worked.
Let's talk for just a moment about how music plays a role, whether it is composed specifically for the film or, you know, borrowing songs from pop culture.
Yeah, music is a major way that filmmakers can inject a lot of emotion into a scene. It's something that, it's also a tool for immersion too, right? Because we get kind of swept away with whatever songs or music that we're hearing. It's important to distinguish between score and soundtrack, as we've talked about before. Score is music that's added after, I mean, all the music is added after, but score is something that is composed specifically for the film. And it refers to music that the characters are not hearing, right? Score is not supposed to be something that we think that those who exist in the film world are experiencing. Instead, it's something that only the audience experiences. And it's then put into various scenes in order to kind of amp up that emotional tension. Soundtrack, on the other hand, can be something that characters are hearing. It also might be something they're not hearing. It just depends on the particular scene or on the particular film. A soundtrack is often like pop songs or songs with lyrics, things like that, that might help set, like a scene in history, right? They might give us insight into a chronology, a moment in time, or they might also be used to create some kind of like emotional catharsis. So I always like to think about Paul Thomas Anderson when we're thinking about soundtrack, because in many examples, especially in his earlier films, he uses soundtrack to kind of confuse that line between whether the audience is only hearing a song or whether we're supposed to think the characters are hearing it as well. So in something like Boogie Nights, in the opening of Boogie Nights, he uses the song Best of My Love to bring us into this club scene that's happening in the 1970s, like in a disco in the 1970s. And we see characters dancing as the song is playing, but we also hear the song continuously as we enter into the club. So it's a really wonderful example of how you can use soundtrack to immerse audiences into what's happening on screen, but also to kind of question whether we're experiencing exactly the same thing that the characters are or not.
Can we talk just a moment again about a film that had maybe the best scoring?
Sure. There's so many that have such amazing score, but one of the ones that I like to talk about that's a bit more recent is Arrival, Denis Villeneuve's Arrival, which I actually just taught in the spring for sound with my undergrads. And I think this score is so fantastic in that film because it really integrates with a larger theme around communication. And it can be hard to distinguish in that film what is score and what is sound effect. And that's one of the things that I really, really love about it. In Arrival, of course, the humans are attempting to communicate with aliens who have landed on Earth, and they don't have the same language. They're trying to figure out how to communicate with beings that have a language that is completely foreign to any possible human language on Earth. And it's coupled, this attempt to communicate is coupled with these very kind of deep and reverberating kind of clangs, these very, very powerful sounds that are almost metallic. And the score comes in and integrates with that in a way that makes these larger sort of inhuman booms and very kind of ominous sounds into something gentler and even a little bit sublime. So I love how that film approaches how we can integrate both sound effect and score.
We are talking right now to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillis. She is an associate professor of English and the director of film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we are talking about how people can watch films like a film buff or a film critic. So Jocelyn, one thing I'm curious about is after we've gone through a few examples, we've gone over these terms, but for people out there that are curious about maybe getting outside of their comfort zone a little bit. Given all the stuff we talked about, is there a movie or two that you might recommend that people sit down and watch with all of this in mind?
Yeah, I think it's a really excellent idea to push yourself a little bit because that's really how we learn, right? It's by challenging ourselves that we begin to understand the kind of wonders of all the possibilities that that film brings to the table. So yeah, it's hard to choose just one, one or two, but I'll try to come up with a couple. One film that I think it's a little bit harder to find, but if you can find this one, I think it did just start streaming on a couple platforms. It's a film called The Fall by Tarsem Singh. And Tarsem Singh was really well known as a music video director at first. He directed the video for Losing My Religion, mm-hmm. the REM video, which is a really, really well-known video for those of us who are ancient as I am.
I love that video, Jocelyn. It's amazing.
You know what I'm talking about. And The Fall was kind of his magnum opus. It comes out in the early 2000s, and it's about a stuntman played by Lee Pace in the 1920s. He's a stuntman for silent films, and he has this terrible accident performing a stunt for one of his films, and then he's stuck in this kind of rehabilitation facility outside of Los Angeles. And while he's there, he meets this little girl who's, she's a member of an immigrant family, and she also has had a fall, and they meet each other in this rehabilitation facility. And he begins to weave this really magical story for her about all of these heroes from different locations around the world who come together to fight this villain and try to save this one, this one kind of princess figure. What's so amazing about this particular film and why it's so useful for kind of integrating all these terms that we're talking about is that Tarsem Singh shot this film all around the world. So there's all these like really fabulous, amazing locations that he uses to craft this fairy tale that's really about the movies. So you can use these kinds of tools that I've mentioned in order to begin to understand how all of these amazing locations from all over the globe come together together to tell a story that's really about the wonder of filmmaking. It's very, very colorful. It's very, very kind of expansive, and it uses music in really wonderful ways and has pretty incredible cinematography as well.
Well, Jocelyn, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much both for your recommendations and for taking us through how to watch films this way.
Thank you so much. It's just always a pleasure.
That was Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She talked to WPR's J. Carlisle Larson about how we could watch movies like a film pro. Coming up Monday on Central Time, catch up with the top stories of the week here in Wisconsin and around the world. That's Monday here on Central Time.